Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. Welcome back to the show.
It's very nice to be back.
How close are we to following up your book title, When the Bubble Bursts?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the signs are starting to pile up that the consumer is finally running out of borrowing capacity. And Canadian Tire results came out about a week ago, and they mentioned that they noticed that their customers are definitely starting to stop spending as much as they used to. And, of course, obviously with interest rates at, say, an average of 6% versus 1% or 2% not that long ago, people with a lot of debt would be highly incentivized to start paying down their debts rather than going to Canadian Tire and buying more stuff. So it's not unusual, but you know, it hasn't really shown up that strongly in the bank report. So on Thursday, as we talk, two big banks, Royal Bank and TD, reported their results. And although there was some sign of an increase in impaired loans, people unable to pay back their loans, the Royal Bank especially decided to lower their provisions for credit losses in the Canadian banking segment, which is their biggest segment, of course. And they based that on the assertion that the global macroeconomic situation and the Canadian macroeconomic situation is improving. And they've revised their forecast for house prices and for the housing market to a more positive view. So we're not there yet. And but as I like to say, I'm not wrong, I'm just early.
Now, do you think housing inventories will increase after Labor Day?
You know, I don't know I certainly noticed in Edmonton that inventories are for sale are up. But the thing about housing bubbles bursting is people that are faced with the prospect of selling their home not below what they paid for, because in many cases they paid a much lower price, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. But the anchor price for a lot of people is the price that a neighbor got 2 years ago at the peak, right? So the peak was 2 years ago, and therefore they're looking at selling, you know, 10%, 20% below that peak. They're more likely to just pull their house off the market rather than accept a discount. So we're in that situation where there's not very many sales because people are reluctant to drop their prices. And we've been in that for a long time. I'm sure that you and I have talked about this before, where there's just kind of a standoff between the buyers and the sellers. The buyers, on the other hand, are unable to reach up to those prices that the seller expects. So the affluent family in Canada has really been hit by the higher interest rates. And, you know, just roughly speaking, if they could have qualified for $800,000 before the interest rates went up, they're now looking at $600,000 maximum loan or even less. But house prices have not come down to reflect that. So there's a lack of buyers. And where we'll see it is because the average homeowner is not forced to sell. It's very seldom that a homeowner is forced to sell right now. You know, they can wait a year or half a year or whatever. We'll be with the new home builders. So the thing to watch is the new home builders. When there's a lot of inventory, either in condos or in single family homes, brand new builds, big developers, hundreds of units that they can't offload. They'll cut the prices. They don't fool around. They have to cut the prices. The people that just bought, 6 months ago for the higher price will be very unhappy with them. But if they have to move that inventory to save their company, they will. And so I haven't seen signs of that. But at some point, perhaps this year, if there's a recession this year, we'll start to see the new home builders cut their prices, and that'll be the major sign that will tell us that the bubble bursting is here.
Yes, and also if the new builds come down in price, that means they'll be the same price as older homes. But why not buy the new one that has warranties and all the new bells and whistles in it?
Exactly, and also the other thing that never gets mentioned in this is actually usually the new home builders can help you arrange financing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're buying an existing home in an old neighborhood, you just have to go to the bank and go through that whole struggle, right? So there's a lot of advantages to buying new. The disadvantage, of course, is that in most cases, in Alberta especially, you have to live quite far out. But with work from home now, it's not such a bad, it's not necessary. You're not necessarily doomed to a daily commute of 45 minutes to an hour each way, morning and night. Maybe you only have to do that once or twice a week, and the rest of the time you can stay home and work from home. So it'll all sort itself out. But the underlying thing that really never gets mentioned is the household debt, which is one of the highest in the world. It's interesting. I'm talking to people. They say, Canada's debt is really bad. It's just terrible. We have to pay it down. There's nothing we can do. They're always, this is 100%, always talking about government debt. The government way too far in debt. The government has to do something. The debt they've built up is way too high. And I sometimes gently point out to them that really the government isn't that worried about its debt because it can always print more money. It's the household and the corporation who are some of the highest debt loads in the world in Canada that are in trouble if they can't meet their commitments because they will have to go through bankruptcy. They don't have the option of printing more money to pay off their debts.
Yeah, you're probably in financial trouble if you need to use a credit card to buy groceries.
Yeah, and we were talking about new homes versus existing homes in terms of a signal. And one of the signals that I don't have I didn't save the graph on it, but credit card debts have gone way up. And I think what that is an early warning sign, canary in the coal mine, that people aren't able to pay off. A lot of people actually pay off their credit. They just use their credit card to get points, right? So they pay off the credit card every month. But what you'll start to see is they can't pay it off, so they just do the minimum payment rather than paying the whole thing off every month. And then, of course, that means when they go to, they go to put more stuff on the credit card, it very quickly goes tilt, and they're not allowed to borrow to make any more purchases. So that may be a warning sign. If we see those credit, we already are seeing credit card outstanding debts on credit cards go up. I think the big one since we last talked was Canadian Tire mentioning in their earnings report, the quarterly earnings report, that they've seen a significant change among the consumers. Because Canadian Tire is a great Canadian bellwether. It's like if anybody saw it early, it would be Canadian Tire. They got stores practically everywhere in Canada, so they would know if something was happening, if there was a big change happening.
Yeah, I know Canadian Tire was talking for a while about including supermarkets in their stores. And I said, I wouldn't buy food in a place that smelled like tires. That's the one thing I wouldn't buy there. I'd be worried about that tire smell getting into my produce. Now, I was taking a look at the bank. Profit reports are coming in. The Royal Bank says its profits are where they predicted they would be, maybe a bit better. But they plan to lay off up to 2% of their staff because their expenses are up 23%. The TD Bank says their expenses are up 24% and they didn't meet their profit targets. What's going on with these big Canadian banks?
Well, so there's a couple of noisy items in there that we have to mention. That is that the Royal Bank bought HSBC. So think they consolidated their results inside the Royal Bank's numbers. So their expenses, of course, would go up because now they got way more employees. So the 23% increase for them was actually more like 13%, according to the Royal Bank, because they added all these branches and all these people. The TD, they're more exposed to the U.S. Than any of the other banks in Canada. And, of course, they have a couple of operations in the U.S. that are similar to some of those. If we think back to March of 2023, just 7 months ago, 6 months ago, there's three large, medium-sized banks that went under, Silicon Valley Bank being the most famous of the three. And TD in the U.S. would be similar size to that. So they're struggling with some challenges down there, and that would be expensive. They had TD had a $305 million expense for having to back out of a purchase. They were going to buy a bank in the U.S., and the regulators wouldn't allow them to buy it. The reasoning was never really revealed. So they had to pay a $305 million breakup fee. Well, that wouldn't be that big a deal for an organization that size. But the thing I was looking for, especially with the Royal Bank, because it's the largest bank in Canada with the largest Canadian exposure, and I was expecting them to show some signs of some of the things that Canadian Tire was talking about, maybe the consumer starting to get into a bit of trouble and stuff. And sure enough, when you look at their impaired loans have gone up. And so I thought, aha, that's it. But then when I go to the bank's view of how things are going, they actually lowered their provisions for credit losses. They're called PCLs. They're a closely watched item. In the Canadian banking division, they actually lowered them by 32% because they felt that there was a better, their forecasters in the macroeconomic department said the outlook had improved in Canada for a better economy, and they changed their housing market forecast for a better housing market. So I just sort of shake my head and think, wow, that's amazing. You know, think about all these Canadians that have all this debt and struggling with all this stuff. But if you read the Royal Bank report, everything's fine. And so they reported an increase in profits in spite of a 13% increase in expenses, non-interest expenses, as they call them. But most of that, maybe all of that, was the result of them lowering their provisions for credit losses. Because the provision for credit losses, of course, are a direct deduction from earnings. So we'll see. At some point, it's certainly taking a lot longer than I thought it would, we'll start seeing the impact of people struggling with higher interest rates start to flow through into the bank earnings, but it hasn't happened in any kind of widespread way so far.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, Evergrande, the second biggest real estate company in China, has filed for bankruptcy protection. Country Garden, the biggest company, I believe, they're also having trouble paying off bond and debt holders. What is that going to spill over to this side of the Pacific?
Oh, you know, that's a great question. Paul Krugman, the Nobel Prize winning economist who writes frequently in the New York Times, wrote a column saying that everybody's thought, you know, about this Chinese problem and said, you know, it won't be a big problem for the U.S. because, and then I forget what the reasons were. I read the whole thing, but I kind of I thought, wow, that's amazing. Well, of course it'll spread worldwide. There's no way that China is the second biggest economy. Depending on how you measure it, it might be the biggest economy in the world. But roughly, the way most usually it's measured, the U.S. is about 22% and China is about 18% of the world economy. So of course it's going to, because the property market in China is the biggest sector of all. And it's quite a bit bigger than Canada's got, probably the second biggest property market as a percentage of GDP in the world, but China's even bigger. And one of the reasons is all of these families, or most of these families in China, are using the property market as a savings. They don't have the safety protection that we have in Canada and the U.S. with all of the provisions for healthcare and unemployment insurance and pensions and all that. They really are kind of on their own when it comes to that sort of thing. The safety net is not that robust. So what they do, for some reason, they got convinced that it was a great idea to buy these apartments, not to live in, but as an investment. They never move into them. So there's hundreds, if not, well, thousands of these buildings, sometimes in the Tier 2 and Tier 3 cities in China, they're sitting empty. And Country Garden was the largest, and China Evergrande was the second largest of people doing, of property developers doing that. So in about June 2021, the problems started to show up in China Evergrande, and in December of 2021, they defaulted in China. Just this month in the U.S., they filed for bankruptcy, Chapter 15. So that was on their U.S. holdings, which should be relatively small. They haven't filed for bankruptcy in China because it's really, they're not going to go bankrupt in China. But they can't meet their obligations. So they've been in talks with the debtors for 2 years now. And of course, the government is very, very concerned in China because some of these people, so there's another wrinkle. I gotta add one more wrinkle in here that is important to know. And that is when you buy a property in China from one of these big developers, you don't just give them the down payment. You go to the bank, you get the mortgage, and you give them the whole amount of the money. So if the apartments there cost less than they do in Vancouver or Toronto, but so let's say they cost 200,000 Canadian, you give them the full 200,000 Canadian. And it's supposed to sit in an escrow account in Country Garden or China Evergrande. Obviously, those companies may have been dipping into those funds to do other things. So the apartments never got completed. So it's potentially a very huge political problem for the government because the average investor can drive by the area where they invested in the thing. They could see that the building is it's a high rise building virtually all the time. They can see that the building is not being built, and they get pretty upset and they contact their local government representative and complain. There's even been protests, although protests are not they're not uncommon in China. Usually the problem gets cleaned up by the government after the protests, but this one's going to be much harder for them to clean up. And now the difference between China Evergrande and Country Garden is Country Garden has four times as many projects. So China Evergrande had about 700-800 projects. Country Garden has the largest, has 3,100 projects. So there's a lot of people involved. If each of those places is 400 apartments, you're talking, millions of units, and that's going to really impact the Chinese economy. And there's several other developers, smaller, that have run into trouble with paying their debts as well. Now, if they default on their debts in the U.S., which obviously they are, that's about 10% of their total debt in the case of China Evergrande. I don't know Country Garden. They haven't defaulted yet. They're into their 30-day grace period on a payment for a loan. So in less than 30 days now, we'll see if they default. But for China Evergrande, they've been in default for 2 years, and now they've filed for bankruptcy in the U.S., which, of course, is a pretty big move for them because it would be an embarrassment for them to have to file for bankruptcy in the U.S. But it was pretty clear from the very beginning that the foreign lenders were probably never going to get paid. Number one priority would be to finish those buildings for those people, those investors. Number two priority would be to pay all the contractors because they'll never finish the buildings if they don't pay the contractors. And then after that would be to repay the lenders, which may or may never happen, may not happen ever. But if some of the lenders get repaid, it'll be the Chinese lenders in China that get paid first, and the foreign lenders will be at the bottom of the list, and undoubtedly they never get paid.
Now, if we have that kind of a spillover here, again, on the West Coast, we have a lot of Chinese investors. Would that be the first hint if they start selling off their homes here to start paying off debt in China?
Well, I've thought about this quite a bit. I guess the thing is the safety. So if things are imploding in China, and there are some articles that are pretty apocalyptic in a way that China's had this amazing boom. I wrote about this in my weekend note, which everybody, by the way, is free to subscribe to. I wrote about it about a week or two ago, and you know, the debt level in China is not just the it's not so much in the household in China, it's in the local government financing vehicles, and it's trillions of dollars. So if it turns out that they can't, you know, the reason the local government financing vehicle gets involved is because they provide the land. So they control the land. They provide the land. They either direct a bank to give the loan to the developer, or they give the loan. You know, they're involved in lending the money themselves, and then the government gets involved, and then the developer builds the units, and everybody's happy until they're not happy. So certainly the more dire predictions are that this debt implosion would be very deflationary for the world, because China will obviously still need to export stuff. It's not really a consumer-driven economy the way ours is. It's only the average Chinese consumer is not nearly as active in consuming the way North Americans are. It's more of an export-driven economy and a capital investment-driven economy. So the two chances for the Chinese government to stimulate the economy, if it's going into a debt deflation spiral, would be to export more, which would be deflationary because they'll cut prices in order to undercut the rest of the world, and they should be able to provide it cheaper than certainly North American factories could, and or to build more infrastructure and capital investment in China. So far, people have been shocked that the Chinese government has not done the amount of stimulus similar to what they did in 2009. It's quite amazing to realize that in 2009, when the Americans were bailing out, you know, the Wall Street banks and GM and Chrysler and all that, they spent trillions of dollars doing that. On a per capita basis, China did something like 10 times as much stimulus, and that stimulus actually spread all over the world and helped save us from a global financial crisis that would have been much worse if the Chinese hadn't done that. So this time it's different. They're not doing the stimulus, and it's a little bit surprising, because by now everybody would have bet a lot of money that by now the Chinese government would have provided quite a large stimulus to the economy. So either the leadership is convinced that it's not the right thing to do, or they're kind of frozen in indecision and they don't know what to do. But they've got lots of very highly trained people working there for them and advising them. So I don't know. It might be an ideology thing that they don't feel like they should be bailing everybody out. But isn't that, it's kind of ironic. The capitalists bail out all the banks and the big companies, and the communists let them go under. It's kind of the opposite of what you'd expect.
Well, let's be honest. The Chinese Communist Party is really the Chinese Fascist Party, because they don't pay for your education. They don't pay for your hospital care. It doesn't sound very socialist to me.
Yeah, the communist, socialist, capitalist labels are getting very confusing.
Pretty blurry.
Very blurred for sure. Yeah.
It's let's just say it. They're not a democracy.
No, as I mentioned that thing about the protests, that's actually their democratic impulse comes from those protests, and it usually works. A whole bunch of people that got stiffed on giving the money to Country Garden to build that apartment, they get together and they stage a big protest, and the government usually swoops in. So that's between them and the local government. Beijing isn't really involved in that. But then when they see the protests, the local representative, the Communist Party representative, reports up the line to Beijing, and Beijing steps in and says, okay, we'll fix it. We'll order the local government authority to fix it. But for some reason, this isn't happening. So maybe the government just doesn't want to print any more money, or some other thing. Well, I'm sure we'll find out eventually, but for now it's a bit of a mystery why they haven't moved more aggressively.
Well, maybe another mystery disease that kills 1-2% of the people that go out and protest will show up. I just thought it was interesting COVID showed up when there were riots in China and Hong Kong. What better way to stop them than make people stay home to avoid a disease that could kill them 1-2% of the time?
Well, you know, along that line, one of the big problems China has is there's a surplus of young males, although it's probably not as great as it was, but they stopped reporting the youth unemployment number because it had gone up so high. There, for a long time in China, there was really no unemployment. You know, the jobs were pretty menial and they weren't very exciting and they weren't very rewarding, but at least you had a job. And but nowadays, the youth unemployment number is rising quite rapidly to quite a high number. And then they stopped reporting the numbers. So now, because of the one-child policy, somehow there seemed to be more boys than girls that actually made it to adulthood.
60 to 40%, yes.
Yeah, and the ratio normally is about 52 to 48. So you've got all these young males wandering around, no job, unhappy, and they're likely to take action. So. I think the President Biden of the United States mentioned this, saying that you know, when people are got a big domestic problem, sometimes they'll do something to distract the population. Well, this is a danger with China, is that they might take some action to sort of muddy the waters so people forget about the local problems, like Country Garden and China Evergrande failing to deliver on their apartments. By starting a war or something similar to that. So that's a big worry. A lot of people have mentioned that in stuff that I read, that and that's that historically that's happened quite often. So I wouldn't be surprised. You know, if they invaded Taiwan, for example, even though the US is committed to supporting Taiwan and all that stuff, I don't suppose that it would start a world war. I don't think the U.S. is going to go to war over Taiwan, even though they're committed with a treaty to help the Taiwanese people. But there's a lot of potential surprises coming from whenever you get a debt deflation spiral, like the U.S. hasn't really had one since the 1930s. There's some really difficult situations that emerge because people just, when the price of the asset is dropping and the incomes are dropping, that debt that they subscribe to looms larger and larger, and there's really nothing they can do to pay it off. So the prehistorical solution was to declare a debt jubilee. When the king was able to do it, because most of the loans were made by the king, he would just cancel all the debts because he didn't want all the peasants to be foreclosed on and lose their land and everything. He needed them to keep producing the food and also to work for him by going in the army to fight wars. So he would cancel all the debts. But nowadays, now good luck. See the thing they're having with the student loan debts, which most of those people will never be able to repay. The government tries to cancel them, but politically it's a very difficult thing.
Well, it seems they should be worried about another Chinese revolution, the U.S. revolution, the Russian revolution, the Chinese revolution, all sparked because people thought their financial situation couldn't get any worse, so what did they have to lose?
Yeah, I mean, if you can't pay your debts, yep, and there's no way out, and the government can't forgive all those debts, which is, you know, going back thousands of years, that's the way they got around this cycle. We're in a cycle of debt, and there isn't really, I mean, people say, well, the one way out of the debt for Canadians, the household debt, would be to have rapidly rising incomes. But you can't have rapidly rising incomes if people don't buy more stuff, and they can't buy more stuff if they don't go deeper into debt. So it's like there's no way out of it. It's been recognized since John Maynard Keynes was writing about it, and even before then. But nobody's figured out how to do it. The one prescription that Keynes had for the situation was for the government to step in and spend a lot of money, and that would provide the income and the money in the system to allow people to slowly and gradually get out from under that debt burden. But if you know, if any government today tried to step in and spend the kind of money that was spent in COVID, for instance, in Canada, over $400 billion deficit, they wouldn't last 5 seconds, I don't think. So it's a very tough problem. There's no real easy solution to it.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our popular YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter @HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.